Indie Media Global Report on Resonance FM 104.4. Check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
Well, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Hello and welcome to this week's Indie Media Global Report on Resonance FM 104.4. We are back after an absence and we see that the studio has moved. We're no longer in Denmark Street. We have now moved to Borough High Street. Normally, we will be broadcasting on Mondays between 11 and 12 at night. But today, we're doing a special broadcast between 7 and 8 on Resonance FM 104.4. The show will be presented and is brought to you by Penny Quinton and Zoe Young. Coming up next, we have Palestine Today, produced by the International Middle East Media Center based in Bethlehem. They are bringing news of President Bush's visit to the region. We are going to hear from Eva Yazovich of Platform and Iraq Occupation Focus, and Kevin Smith, who works for Carbon Trade Watch, is just reporting back from the climate conference in Bali. Hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January the 10th, 2008. As Bush visits the Palestinian cities of Bethlehem and Ramallah, Israeli army attacks leave two Palestinians dead in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. During his visit to the region, the President of the United States of America, George Bush, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met in the central West Bank city of Ramallah on Thursday morning, where they had brief talks and afterwards they had a joint press conference. First to take the floor was President Abbas, who welcomed Bush and deemed his visit as historical. Abbas added that the Palestinians wish for peace, freedom and stability, and asked Bush to help them accomplish that. "Do you want a democratic Palestinian state or the status quo?" Bush asked in the news conference. He also failed to mention any of the core issues that Palestinians strive to solve, such as borders, refugees, Jerusalem, prisoners, and the wall, but instead focused on fighting terrorism. Meanwhile, in Ramallah City, outside the press conference, dozens of Palestinians were wounded and at least 10 arrested in Ramallah when Palestinian police attempted to disperse a demonstration opposing the visit of the US President George Bush on Thursday morning. Mohammed Al-Khatib, a member of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, was among those who were detained, along with a cameraman who works for Man News, a local Palestinian news agency. During his one-day visit to the Palestinian areas, Bush arrived on Thursday midday to the Nativity Church, located in the centre of the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The Palestinian Authority security forces have placed the city under strict security measures since last night, restricting movement between villages and towns neighbouring Bethlehem, shutting down the entire city. Bush was greeted inside the church by several Palestinian and religious officials. After a short tour inside the church that lasted 15 minutes, President Bush and his convoy left the city, where he was lifted by air to Jerusalem. Across the street from the Nativity Church, a few hundred Palestinians gathered and raised signs demanding Bush to force Israel to stop building settlements and attacking Palestinians in order for peace to happen. Palestinian security hassled the crowd and arrested and detained some of the demonstrators for some time before letting them go. Hours before Bush arrived to the Palestinian areas, several Israeli army invasions were reported across the West Bank, and an Israeli army attack on Gaza left two dead. Thank you for joining us from occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org. This report was brought to you by Caroline Jones and Ghassan Banoura.
with Eva Yazovich. Eva is part of Iraq Occupation Focus, and she's currently working for Platform, which campaigns about environmental issues associated with oil and much, much more. Eva's here to talk about the advances that the government are making in their privatisation policy of Iraq's oil. Is the privatisation going to help the people in Iraq?
Ultimately, people of Iraq are going to lose out if the kind of contracts, production sharing agreements, privatisation contracts that will last 40 years, a generation. If these contracts are signed, they will lock Iraq into a relationship with corporations which will control the majority of the development, the extraction, the rate of depletion of Iraq's primary asset, which is oil. And oil accounts for approximately 95% of government revenue. It is Iraq's primary industry. It is Iraq's economy. And the people of Iraq stand to lose billions and billions of dollars if such agreements go ahead. Iraq doesn't need these kind of agreements. None of Iraq's neighbours have PSAs, not Iran.
What are PSAs?
Production sharing agreement is a type of contract that is usually used in countries that have difficult to access oil reserves or a very nascent oil industry or very low oil reserves, not in a country with a developed and experienced oil industry and engineers and experts and with the third largest oil reserves in the world. It's not a country that has difficult to access reserves. These are known in industry terms as low-hanging fruit. They are very easy to extract. It's about $1.50 a barrel extraction costs. You compare that to the Canadian oil sands, which I think are about $25 a barrel.
Can you tell me a little bit about the laws that have led to the situation where Iraq's oil could be privatised?
Okay, well, first you have the flouting of international law and the invasion and occupation of Iraq and still this continuing brutalising illegal occupation. Legally speaking, Iraq is without a petroleum investment regime. This is what the oil law is all about. At the moment, it's still producing, it's still exporting, it's regulating itself. The Ministry of Oil is regulating the industry. It's still a nationalised industry. But the processes that have allowed for this privatisation agenda to emerge and for the law itself to emerge begin really with Iraq's debt and the International Monetary Fund. At the time of the war, Iraq was the most indebted country in the world. It had approximately $200 billion worth of debt, and per capita was the most indebted country in the world. One of the conditions of the standby agreement for Iraq, created by the creditor countries, the Paris Club countries, including Britain and America and the IMF, was that Iraq would have to complete a number of privatization measures, stabilization measures, including the installation of a corporate-friendly, a free market-friendly petroleum regime. Herbert Dosina of Focus on the Global South has done a lot of writing on how Iraq's constitution was remoulded following the 2003 war and how successive drafts were gradually changed to reflect a free market agenda to the point that the free market became enshrined in the constitution. Iraq must have a free market constitution. Iraq's constitution also says that it must fight terrorism. It may be the only country in the world that has such a constitution. And this is due to the fact that it was written under occupation. Salami Khalilzad, the ambassador, American ambassador to Iraq, was present for most of the drafting process and all the progressive measures, because originally the constitution would have made Iraq a bit like Sweden in terms of its social provision and policies on free education and free healthcare and unemployment benefit, etc. That's been changed. So the constitution was turned into a pro-free market constitution. Then Iraq had to agree to various provisions, slashing fuel subsidies, slashing the food ration, and opening up its oil sector to foreign investment by corporations.
What kind of timetable are we looking at for all this legislation?
Well, the IMF originally set December 2006 as the deadline for an oil law. The first draft was written in the summer of 2006, and within weeks of it being completed, it was seen by 9 multinational oil companies, the British government, the American government, and the IMF. The Iraqi people, Iraqi MPs, saw it for the first time 8 months later in February. And civil society, trade unions, the Iraqi people have been cut out completely from the process. They haven't been consulted. There's been no meaningful engagement or democratic process at all, which is unsurprising because it's an occupied country with an occupation government controlled by Washington. Then came the sort of jostling within between cabinet members, also with the Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions, the most powerful trade union in Iraq, threatening to shut down exports, to take strike action if they were not included in the consultation process. All the trade unions in Iraq signed a joint document in December 2006 saying that production sharing agreements, privatization of the oil sector and any public sector industries is a red line that cannot be crossed. We are in 2008 now. The oil law has been delayed by over a year because of wrangling between sectarian elites within the Iraqi government, but also because of the mass civil society opposition. Iraqi experts, oil experts, technocrats living in exile have also written numerous letters to the Iraqi prime minister and oil minister saying that now is not the time to be passing legislation or signing deals that will lock Iraq into contractual conditions that reflect now Iraq as an occupied country, as a war-torn, on the verge of civil war country in 2007 that will last for generations. Because once those contracts are signed, they will have international treaty status and Iraq will not be able to renegotiate on anything unilaterally. It will have to go through either voluntarily with the oil companies or through an investment tribunal where Iraq, a country representing 30 million people, will be treated on the same footing as a corporation, as Shell, which is only accountable to its investors, whereas Iraq is accountable to its people and to a health service and welfare and the future living standards of generations to come. Now, the oil companies don't care about this. They want to access the third largest oil reserves in the world, the largest untapped oil reserves in the world. The reserves to production ratio in Iraq is something like 173 years. In Saudi Arabia, it's about 60 years now because it's been so depleted. Iraq also has trillions of cubic feet of natural gas. It is a gold mine for oil corporations. Some people look at Iraq and think, my God, it's a CO2 nightmare. It's just this enormous carbon well, and we don't want that oil to come out the ground. Some people will be saying that. It would be much easier to minimize oil production if the Iraqi people so want that. Iraq could, and there are Iraqi experts saying this, Fuad al-Amir had this theory, and which was that Iraq could lower its production but raise the price that it gets back for its oil, and it could do this in conjunction with OPEC. So Iraq would not lose financially, but would be able to start putting measures in that would preserve the environment more. Now, I'm not in a position, we're not really in a position to tell Iraqi people what's best for them and what to do and how their industry can work, because really in Iraq, people see the oil industry as their future. They see it as their economic future. The Iraqi government, whatever it's going to be, whatever kind of system of democracy or what it's going to be in the future, people are not going to be able to say, actually, we want to diversify away from our reliance on the oil industry, want to explore solar power, or want to explore hydroelectric power, because two of the biggest rivers in the Middle East flow through Iraq. They won't be able to do that if their oil industry or if that resource is mortgaged to their economy and mortgaged to oil companies, which in their own interests, in their profit-making interests, will be seeking to maximize that production. They won't be able to say, actually, no, we want to stop that, because it won't be in their control. Really, what this could lock Iraq into is a dependence on oil as their main source of revenue. So that inhibits the sovereignty of Iraq to explore alternative avenues. And also, if we are going to look to the future of keeping oil in the ground, then it's going to be much easier to negotiate with a people's movement, a people's government in Iraq, which will take into account human needs and not the profit-seeking corporations.
Is there some kind of movement on the ground that is saying this? Are there groups within Iraq who are saying, no, we don't want the oil taken out?
No, it's politically impossible to say that at the moment in Iraq. It's tantamount to saying you're going to keep starving. The agenda first is sovereignty for the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people decide how they develop their resources and what needs to be done. If we trust in a progressive movement, in a progressive people's government that is going to take into account the needs of the people, the needs of Iraq's neighbours and the world, this in time, I think, will produce a different dynamic, one of hope. This is about hope, basically. This is about creating a space where this could happen, and it won't happen if multinational oil corporations control Iraq's oil development.
What kind of grassroots people's movements are happening on the ground?
Well, there's the workers' movement, trade unionists. The Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions is very powerful, is doing a lot of organising and educating and letting people know what privatisation is. A lot of workers weren't really familiar with what privatisation was. Conceptually, they hadn't had that experience at all. You know, talking people in their 40s and 50s don't remember such a thing. So union activists are explaining what this is going to mean. People are explaining what production sharing agreements are. And the Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions was so effective in popularising the term production sharing agreement and what this would mean for the Iraqi economy and ordinary people's living standards, that it became a household term. People began to use this word. They knew what it was. No one in this country is really aware of what PSA was. It became such a popularized term in Iraq that it was dropped from the original draft of the oil law. They couldn't use it. It was too much of a political hot potato. People who are not organized at all don't want their oil, their resource, stripped away from them by the companies belonging to the states which authorized the invasion of their country and are profiting from it and continue to profit from it. Profit from their blood. You know, they are, for them, they've had enough blood for oil. Now they really don't want to see any oil for their blood.
2 million people protested in London against the war. What's happened to all that resistance? How do you think people that were so against the war could maybe help Iraq in its current plight?
I think a lot of that resistance dissolved to a degree because people felt that they'd failed, that they hadn't managed to stop the war, that despite their best efforts, it still went ahead. So what was left to do if the government wouldn't respond to such a huge show of public force? Then I think people got despondent. But I mean, that's one narrative. The other narrative is that lots of vibrant local anti-war groups set up and carried on being active and carried on marching and demonstrating and commemorating. And that's been a bit of a hidden story. What I think we are in a position to affect is that which hasn't happened yet. You know, we all had this huge energy going because Iraq had not been invaded and we wanted to stop it. We wanted to stop that brutal, terrible, violent process from happening. Another brutal, terrifying, violent process is underway, but hasn't yet happened. And that is the pillage of Iraq's economy, the pillage of its resources by foreign corporations under the patronage of this country and America and Italy and other countries that are sponsoring their oil companies to get a slice of the Iraqi pie. That hasn't happened yet. We are in a position to make sure that it doesn't happen. We're in a position to support people in Iraq, to show them that we understand that this theft is being planned, that we support them in resisting it, that we support trade unionists in resisting it, that we can send them money and that we can demonstrate, we can get out on the streets and we can target these oil companies and we can show people that they are trying to deal in war loot. They are dealing in blood, that they are trying to cash in on blood for oil, basically.
So where can your average Londoner start?
Well, they can start by joining the Hands Off Iraqi Oil campaign. This is a coalition campaign. It's not a group. It's a coalition of organisations. War on Want platform. We're having a day of action on Saturday, February the 23rd. It's happening all around the country. We're asking groups, local groups, to target their local Shell and BP petrol stations and do whatever they see fit. And we in London are going to be targeting institutions and companies that have been involved in the theft of Iraqi oil, in planning that theft, and we'll be targeting Shell and BP petrol stations too. We want as many groups to take part in this as possible, so it will send a really clear message to our friends in Iraq that we are rooting for them, that we are standing in solidarity with them, and that these companies are dealing in war loot and that their behaviour is criminal, that what they're doing is akin to plunder and pillage. So we really hope people will take action, and we've got loads of resources on the Hands Off Iraqi Oil website, which is handsoffirakioil.org. We've got a Mythbusters fact sheet, we've got downloadable posters, we can send people stickers, there's leaflets, so you've got all the gear there really to have your own protest. And we're also reviving the wonderful corporate pirates crew, me hearties, and we really want people to get dressed up as pirates, to parody, to satirize these companies, because they are corporate pirates, they are pillagers, they are waging war on people and robbing them. So we want that kind of imagery, that association. And people love dressing up as pirates. It's good fun. And my pirate name is Hearty McCutlass.
Where are those pirates going to dock?
Well, we'll be visiting our friends, formerly known as Windrush Communications. They've dissolved that company name. They're now called the Development Program. This is a company which specializes in bringing in the private sector and organizing events that allow for private companies to cash in on post-war conflict situations. While there's still blood on the ground, they're organizing conferences sponsored by Shell, BP, Aranis, private military companies, the biggest companies in the world, to come and meet with representatives from ruling elites in countries like Sudan. There's a Sudan development program. There's the Iraq development program. There's a humanitarian development program. There's a water development program. And these are dressed up as humanitarian initiatives, but they are about breaking into new markets and spreading free market fundamentalist policies and ambitions. And they run completely counter to the essence of solidarity and mutual aid and giving that people need. They don't need Bechtel coming in and privatizing their water off the back of a war. We don't like them very much. They're based in Old Street, which is the heart of sort of liberal NGO community. So we'll still know they're based in the same offices. They can't change their name. We know their game, and we're going to come visit them. But really, we need to be exposing the activities of these companies, because it is so disingenuous to present their activities as humanitarian when really they are so ultimately disempowering to the people who are suffering from the shock of war. This is sort of classic kind of shock doctrine style economics and economic exploitation, and it's just as violent as war itself. We need to be associating these companies that happily sit away in their converted church, organizing glittering conferences in beautiful, beautiful, luxurious hotels whilst there's blood on the ground and people are being killed and are not even able to orientate themselves enough to be able to take back what is theirs and is being stolen.
Thanks very much. You're listening to Resonance FM, and you've just been hearing Eva Jazovic.
This is Zoe Young with Indie Media Global Report's special show on Thursday. We'll be going back to Monday nights as of next week from 11 till 12. So this week, one of the things I'm presenting is some audio from a film that we've just made for Friends of the Earth International and the European Network on Debt and Development. And this DVD is available from Friends of the Earth International. It's all about oil and public money being used to extract oil and the economic conditionality which leaves people starving across the world and which privatises resources such as water. And so we're going to play some of the audio. A lot of the testimonies featured in this film are actually not in English, so we'll only be playing one of the audios, which is from Nigeria. And we'll also have some of the final statement from Meda Patka, who some of you may have heard of from the struggle against the Narmada dams in India. So, yeah, here we have World versus Bank.
Nosotros venimos para acusar al Banco Mundial.
He acts as an enforcer to the oil multinationals.
Public opinion is not taken into consideration, and information on the implementation of projects remain a secret from the people.
The World Bank loans and conditionalities are a threat to our very hard-won democracy.
Elas, la Banco Mundial.
What is most compelling about these stories is not their uniqueness. These stories are part of thousands of similar stories across the globe.
A series of internal and external assessments of how the largest development institution in the world, in charge of promoting sustainable development and reducing poverty worldwide, clearly say that banks' operations, analysis, and researches fail to achieve the mandate of the institution. That's why we are here today, right here in Den Haag, a city which is a well-known symbol of international justice. Welcome all of you to the World versus Bank, the public hearing on the World Bank.
For those of us who have had the opportunity of visiting Nigeria, of visiting the Niger Delta where I live and where I work, today it's in the news for the wrong reasons. Militants are kidnapping hostages. Our communities are fighting each other. This same land space is being contested by the oil multinationals who have taken over our lands, destroyed our rivers, killed our fishes, our way of life. Chevron Texaco, Shell wants to go into a construction project. They require the presence of the World Bank. It acts as an enforcer to the oil multinationals. And we see a pattern forming. You look at the Bujagali Dam project, the Trans-Saharan gas pipeline, the West African gas pipeline. World Bank and multinational oil companies working together to corner the energy sector in Africa. It was supposed to be the new face of the World Bank, the West African gas pipeline project. But I think the experience has been different. The West African gas pipeline was granted fiscal, environmental, and social exemptions. In fact, in Ghana, the West African Gas Pipeline Treaty was passed in one day. Before we knew what was happening, the National Assembly in Nigeria had also passed the West African Gas Pipeline Treaty. They have taken sides with multinational oil companies and international financial institutions against their people. When the World Bank started with this project, we raised an alarm. We said this project will intensify the flaring of gas in our communities. But the World Bank didn't listen to us. It went ahead. The gas that will be used for the West African gas pipeline project is what's known as the non-associated gas. It does not come with oil. The gas that you see being burned comes with oil. You drill oil, it has some gas on top of it, and so you need to move the gas aside. You have 120 of those flare sites in the Niger Delta, continuously 24 hours of the day burning. You have roaring flames. You can't hear. It causes cancer, causes lung diseases. The flaring of gas in Nigeria is one of the biggest contributors to climate change from Africa. And although the World Bank has outlined some minimum social and environmental safeguards, it has spectacularly failed to implement any of them. We don't want big, massive projects. We want to decentralize, efficient, sustainable energy projects. Thank you.
Following what Michael said, there is an international declaration, it's called End Oil Aid. It's asking rich government and multinational institutions like the World Bank to stop using public money for big oil companies. And it's currently signed by more than 300 organizations.
And maybe, you know, us in the West should start thinking about having a sort of post-colonial view and reinterpret also what we mean by solidarity, because many of our friends and comrades, they know what they want. They're not victims. They don't want to consider themselves as victims. And I think this is a big challenge to all of us.
Thanks to all those who have deposed, coming long way. I suppose as members of the panel, we have the task first of concluding what has come out of the presentations.
The fossil fuel extraction that the bank is furthering is against the post-Kyoto processes, and that cannot be easily acceptable. The World Bank has gone ahead in the extractive industries in spite of what was brought up by the extractive industries review. To get the lending, the conditionalities invariably lead the country into privatization. That leads to the unjustifiable profits on one hand in the monetary terms, but it also leads to much of ecological destruction. Irrespective of or ignoring the traditional and customary rights, but also the legal and constitutional rights. The United Nations covenants and conventions, such as the ILO Convention 169 for the indigenous people, were also ignored. And while bank always boasts of its participatory mechanisms and the dialogues with the CSOs and the NGOs, that results in very little resolution of conflict, if at all. There is a need and urgency to build up on local resistances and alternatives to the dominant economic free trade and growth-oriented paradigm. The bank should abstain from supporting the privatization of commons and of life-supporting resources.
I'm here with Kevin Smith from Carbon Trade Watch, who was at the Bali climate negotiations late last year. So we're going to get a little report back from what it was really like, what was really going on, and what was happening outside on the streets. Kev, can you tell us a bit about your organisation and what you were doing in Bali, please?
My organisation is Carbon Trade Watch, which is a project of a think tank based in Amsterdam called the Transnational Institute. What we're doing is monitoring and researching and providing a body of critical research on the use of carbon trading as a means of dealing with climate change. The evidence is showing it's not reducing emissions, and in the process it's making enormous profits for some of the biggest climate criminals out there, and it's also having a devastating impact on a number of communities in the global south. In Bali, we were there to see what was going on, and to network with some of the other organisations there to try and raise awareness that carbon trading isn't the panacea that is being presented, that it's not reducing emissions, and there needs to be some drastic changes in climate policy at the national and international level if we're going to start bringing about the desperately needed emissions reductions.
And what was going on at the meeting? I mean, were people hearing this message, or what were the negotiators doing and saying? What was the meeting actually trying to achieve?
One of the main objectives of the meeting was to start laying the groundwork for what the post-Kyoto deal is going to be, what's going to happen after 2012 when the current phase of the Kyoto Protocol runs out. In reality, very little was agreed in a substantive way towards making binding agreements to countries to reduce their emissions. It was again all good intentions and very vaguely worded promises to maybe do things in the future. But what was agreed upon was new ways to expand the carbon market, to create new opportunities for carbon trading. And what was agreed was entrenching international financial institutions like the World Bank as the main agents of being involved in that process, and of being the overseers of funds like the Adaptation Fund, and overseeing the funds in the case of a technology transfer and so on.
So what is the Adaptation Fund, and isn't it a good thing that big experienced institutions should be taking on a role in this really important process?
The Adaptation Fund is supposed to provide financial assistance for southern countries who are going to be bearing the brunt of the devastating effects of climate change. It's money to provide them with what they need to deal with the impending and current climate catastrophe. It's so urgently necessary. The sort of sums they're talking about at the moment are a tiny fraction of what development agencies like Oxfam are saying are going to be necessary on a year-by-year basis. I think they say the southern countries are going to need something like $50 billion a year in order to deal with the effects of climate change. And what's being proposed at the moment is a tiny fraction of that. However, having the World Bank playing a central role in that is incredibly problematic, because the World Bank is essentially an undemocratic institution. It's run on a $1 one vote basis, which means that the US pays the most and has the most control over the World Bank. So the US, despite not having any binding targets or having agreed to kind of reduce its emissions, gets to, albeit in a secondhand way, play a key role in determining how that money is used and where it goes to. And the World Bank's also very controversial, just because amongst populations in the global south, it has an awful reputation, because the vast majority of the projects that it's been involved with have appalling human rights records and environmental rights records. And social movements in the south and the average people in the south have witnessed firsthand the appalling impacts that a lot of World Bank funded projects have had, and they don't want to have the World Bank determining who gets the money. They want a more democratic institution to see how that money gets allocated.
So in London we had a demonstration on the 8th of December with the campaign against climate change, and seems to be calling for, you know, more government action and more eco-friendly light bulbs and so forth. You were mentioning that there were demonstrations on the streets in Bali during the meetings there. Can you tell us a bit about who was demonstrating and what they were calling for?
Well, with all respect to the people who put time and energy into the demonstration in London, I get very frustrated with the constant focus on demonstrating outside the US embassy calling for the US to sign Kyoto. I think this has a real political short-sightedness because it's not really kind of having any analysis of what's going on with Kyoto. It's placing all the focus on the US rather than looking at what the Kyoto Protocol actually contains. And it contains a lot of really undesirable things in terms of carbon trading and the things to be done around the world in the name of carbon trading. So I think we should be focusing less of our attention on pressuring the US to sign and focusing more of our attention on whether the Kyoto Protocol is even desirable in the first place, which I think is still a very valid question. I'm not saying a definite yes or a definite no. Now, the main difference between my experience of these marches in London and my experience of this march in Bali, which was made up of various social movements from Indonesia, a lot of kind of peasant organizations from Indonesia convened, was there was a focus on institutions like the World Bank and the IMF as being a very fundamental part of the problem of climate change. And there's a real recognition that economic neoliberal policy, through its kind of focus on economic expansion, uber alles, and opening up new markets and so on, is one of the biggest drivers of climate change through its dependency upon year increased fossil fuel consumption extraction. So I think there's a real awareness that the struggle against neoliberal economic imperialism and the struggle against climate change are one and the same. And I think a lot of the groups campaigning on climate change in the UK lack this more systemic analysis of the situation with climate change.
So it seems quite surreal that the same institution which is investing public money in fossil fuel extraction and the same institution which seems to have messed up hosting the Global Environment Facility, which was supposed to have been preventing climate change for the past 15, 20 years, suddenly is now being given the money for coping with the adaptation. I presume that means sort of building sea walls and things like that. And can you say a bit more about what the World Bank is actually doing?
It's an enormous contradiction. The World Bank is involved in international policy on climate change in so many levels. You've got various carbon funds that the World Bank has set up that's promoting various carbon offset projects in a lot of southern countries through the Clean Development Mechanism. And this is enormously controversial. So many of these projects have been exposed for not bringing any of the development benefit that they're supposed to bring, for not really being additional, for not providing any extra climate benefit. And the World Bank is actually making a commission on all of the carbon credits that are being sold through its various carbon funds. So it's a big source of income for it. Then you've also got the World Bank was also mandated by the G8 plus 5 climate dialogue, which was at Glen Eagles. They set up a specific G8 plus 5 institution to come up with a climate change package for the G8 summit in Japan later this summer. And the World Bank has been mandated by this G8 plus 5 to shape this package. And of course, the package that it's advocating is things like carbon trading. It's things like nuclear power, it's things like carbon capture and storage, and these are all very hotly contested, controversial solutions to climate change, which in my opinion aren't going to deal with the problem. And nowhere at all is it talking about making significant moves to leave the majority of fossil fuels in the ground, which is the only incontrovertible way we're going to deal with the climate crisis.
So what was it actually like in Bali? I mean, presumably there were officials from the World Bank, from all the various governments around the world. And what about the big NGOs that say that they're going to try and prevent climate change through their campaigns and lobbying in meetings like this?
One of the horrible things about the climate talks is the degree to which it's been permeated by the carbon trading lobby. There were some 4,000 plus delegates from the NGO community taking part in the talks, and of those 4,000 and something, the biggest NGO that was represented there wasn't WWF, it wasn't Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, it was the International Emissions Trading Association that had 7% of the NGO delegates at the talks, whereas WWF and Greenpeace, I think, had 1 point something percent each. So there was this enormous presence there. They also had their own separate block, their own kind of meeting space where they hosted side events throughout the 2 weeks of the conference. So like most NGOs had to go and register side events and could maybe squeeze in one or two, but they got to host their own kind of massive separate section. So they're really kind of on board in transforming the climate talks away from talking about genuine solutions to climate change into how we can make money out of the carbon market in the context of Kyoto. And to a large extent, the climate talks have changed now to become little more than a trade show for carbon trading and the carbon industry.
So who are these people and where do they get off on doing this stuff?
It's enormously, it's very powerful business industries. Carbon trading represents a whole new arena for capital flows. There's billions and billions of pounds being made on this. London itself is one of the hubs of the carbon trading industry in the city. And all the kind of major banks now have a kind of carbon dealing part to them. And there's so many different, there's a whole new profession springing up of very well salaried carbon bureaucrats and traders who are making enormous amounts of money off this carbon market. Almost none of it's going to community run renewable projects or whatever. It's all kind of being passed around between multinationals and some of the most polluting industries like power generators, aluminium factories, paper mills and so on.
So to bring it back to London, as you just did, I saw an article in the Metro today, which was, that'll be yesterday when this goes up, suggesting ways to get rid of that lump of carbon hanging around your neck. And it seemed to be suggesting that the carbon trade was the way forward. And that's the mainstream discourse now, isn't it? Is there anything that people can do? Where can they get information to sort of open up this issue and find out what they can really do to get us out of this hole we seem to be digging deeper?
We've released a publication called The Carbon Neutral Myth, Offset Indulgences for Your Climate Sins, that people can get from the Carbon Trade Watch website, which is www.carbontradewatch.org. And there you'll find some more articles that are talking in a more critical way about Kyoto, about carbon trading and offsetting. And if people go to www.tni.org, and look at the environmental justice section of the website, they'll find a lot more information as well.
And if people are interested in taking action, I mean, are there, presumably these people, they're having meetings, they're promoting their agenda through newspapers that go to everybody like the Metro and through even the mainstream broadsheet newspapers and the TV news and so forth. And when they have their meetings, are there groups that go along and sort of try and make sure that the alternative point of view is presented, and how can people get involved?
It's happened a number of times. One of the groups that's been particularly active in London is Rising Tide London. Over the course of the last year, they occupied the offices of the Carbon Neutral Company, one of the UK's most high-profile offset providers. And then I think in November as well, there was a conference on aviation and emissions trading, bringing aviation into carbon trading schemes. And they were also doing actions round about that as well. So there has been a response. Also at the Camp for Climate Action last summer, one of the targets that was chosen by, I think it was a Plain Stupid group, was the climate care offices in Oxford. They invaded the office dressed as red herrings to symbolise the fact that carbon offsets are a distraction away from taking genuine action on climate change.
Thank you very much indeed, Kevin Smith of Carbon Trade Watch. Let's hope that we get some more practical action coming through soon.
Ramparts is a social centre in East London and has run lots of events for the last 4 years. It's been up for eviction in early December. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, the papers arrived on the 13th of December and the court was on the 20th, which meant that there were only 5 days left for us to prepare some kind of a defence. The papers were actually written and printed on the 5th of December, but they waited that long to leave as minimal time for us to prepare. And the court was on the 20th.
What happened when you went to court?
It was a very, very, very long court case, 3.5 hours. It was quite painful to see how the judge was swaying from one side to the other. Kind of, it seemed that he couldn't make up his mind how to rule.
Did he give you leave to appeal?
Well, he gave us 14 days, which is next to nothing, because we mentioned that there's loads of groups involved in the Rampart that need to have some time to move and to find a new place. Maybe he calmed his heart and thought about Christmas and giving us a present of 14 days.
Was the process any different, say, to a home eviction? So often when people go to court and they're squatting a property, they're given just 24 hours to get out. Why do you think Ramparts was treated differently?
We were arguing that there was a licence given to us by the owner due to various incidents where there was kind of a quid pro quo arrangement of us doing him favours and him, you know, seemingly allowing us to stay there. We had quite a bit of evidence of that and the judge seemed quite convinced, and at one stage we fought that we would actually win the case. But at the end of the day, what he did instead was simply to grant the claimants their possession, but give us 2 weeks before that possession order was made valid. We were given until the 3rd of January to get out. That was Christmas and New Year period and quite difficult to get any legal advice or discover what to do next. However, we managed to put together an appeal, which we lodged on the 3rd of January. My understanding is that that puts a kind of a halt on any attempts by the claimant to get a warrant to get the bailiffs to get us out. We're now waiting for the appeal date. We haven't been told what the appeal date would be. We should hear within a few more days.
The judge stated that it was a license of will that we had from the owner to use the building as a social centre. And there was even the assistant of the owner telling us, oh, the owner is really happy about what you're doing and we're happy that you're staying in the building. And if property has to be eventually to be developed, then we're going to find a new house so you can continue with your good work.
Why do you think social centres are important to the community?
Because there aren't enough places where people can meet, where people have access to information which is not mainstream, which is not processed, which is more authentic. There's not many places where people can gather together without any urge to spend money. People aren't forced to consume things, where people can just be free in what they want to do. Free spaces. The Rampart is a place where people can take the chance to take on responsibility for their lives and what they're doing and for their environment.
I think social centres, well, there's various different models of social centres and it's kind of a meaningless term without some context. But I think that in the UK context, it's about providing non-commercial spaces where people can put on the type of events or activities which it would be hard to find another venue to do, because normally another venue has to pay its rent, etc. And in order to do so, then the users of that space have to be contributing financially. So activities which can't contribute financially or not significantly enough don't get the space. And in autonomous social centres, that's not true, because money isn't the motivating factor. So it enables people to put on events, the type of events that you just won't find elsewhere. And you can do events where there's going to be no exchange of money at all, where it might be an exchange of skills. I think what this does is facilitate the ability for people to get together and organise in ways which aren't, you know, mediated by someone trying to make a buck out of them.
What kind of things happened at Ramparts?
We've had film festivals, a regular women's cafe, cinema nights, poetry slams, gatherings for various campaigns like the climate camp or the arms trade protest, performance artists. We've had radical book reading theory group, various radio collectives producing stuff there.
What's your favourite event that happened in Ramparts over the last 4 years?
That is a very difficult question. We had a gigantic peace not war event in 2004. There was the European Social Forum in London, and we had people from all over the world coming to the Rampart, staying there. Then we had Punk Purim, which was also a buzzing event.
Tell me about Punk Purim.
It was quite an anarchist Jewish holiday, which was celebrated at the Rampart with a lot of music, great Hebrew hip-hop, and
Fiddler on the Roof.
And Sharon bashing cabaret. It was amazing how many people came from all over the world. Like, there was this guy from Hungary, and he came and he had an invitation, a flyer that somehow made the way to Hungary, and he found it there. Another thing which I really, really like is the alternative health clinic. Consultations by a homeopath. She gave remedies to people and was treating people just for an exchange. People brought something and she was treating them. I think that's a beautiful example for a non-monetary exchange.
A good example of an event which was put on at the Rampart, which would have been difficult to do elsewhere, was a debate about the attempted censorship of the Fundamental album called The Benefits of Jihad. We had a very, very active debate, a member of the band there talking about what was going on with his record company and calls by various MPs to have them arrested under the Terrorism Act and stuff. And I know that when people tried to organise a similar event in Oxford, the police put pressure on the venue to get it cancelled, and they didn't try to pressurise us to get it cancelled.
Yeah, because you have had some problems with the police outside at protest times photographing people going in and out of Ramparts.
Yeah, I mean, generally we've had very little attention by the police. We've had the so-called forward intelligence team standing outside taking photos in an attempt to intimidate people attending some public meetings. But that's been pretty much it. I'd say, you know, maybe 5 or 6 times over the last 3.5-4 years.
What's your favourite memory from Ramparts?
Oh, God. Oh, I can't say. It has something to do with an axe.
What's your favourite memory that's broadcastable?
Okay, well, I think it was actually doing radio. We did, while the G8 was in Scotland, those of us that had to stay in London to look after the squat started doing some radio coverage of what was going on in Scotland. Turned into kind of this 5-day live marathon with no sleep. You know, people doing really stupidly long shifts. And then, of course, we had the bombings of the 7th of the 7th. Because we already had this international audience listening to our coverage of what was going on with the G8 mobilisations, it became that people were coming to Rampart radio station to listen to what was going on in London with the bombings, which was interesting because it was being rebroadcast by various groups and FM stations around the world.
What will happen if the Ramparts goes?
We had a meeting on Sunday, which was an attempt to talk about London social centres generally and the need to get more of them open and keep some continuity between the resources and the group using spaces when squatted social centres are evicted. What came out of that was, first of all, the news that there are 2, maybe 3 new buildings either already opened or about to be opened, which are planned to be new social centres. Also, various working groups looking at putting together a communication structure between the social centres so that the events at all the social centres are much easier to publicise. It's much easier for people to find out going on in all these radical spaces. It's easier for people to get involved. But more importantly, some attempt to focus on the resources and the groups and the events as the important things rather than the spaces which come and go and are lost. So an attempt to look at how we can take the resources from one space that's closing down and move into a new space, and how groups which are using those spaces can kind of hop from one to the other with much less disruption of events. Currently, there's a serious lack of social centres in London when you consider the size of London compared to, for example, Milan has a population of, I believe...
In Milan, it's 1.5 million people and they have 15 social centres. So if you compare that to London, it's pretty poor what we've got here. It's not the lack of buildings, but maybe it's also the size of London, and to get people together and get something up and running is really difficult.
It's definitely not the lack of buildings. About 100,000 empty properties in London, 800,000 empty properties in the country. The reason for the lack of radical autonomous spaces is something other than a problem squatting. That's definitely not the problem. It might be the longevity of these spaces. In Rome, where there's about 30 social centres, frequently have lifespans of 20, 25, 30 years, whereas here you're talking typically 3 to 6 months.
So the Rampart has been exceptional.
The Rampart has been quite exceptional, in certainly in terms of recent history, for the length of time it stayed open. But it's just the luck of the draw.
If people want to get involved and help out, what can they do?
The collective that runs the Rampart Social Centre has been meeting every Monday since the beginning, and we'll continue to do so. Those meetings also are discussing a future, kind of Rampart 2, as it were. There's a meeting on the 2nd of February, a meeting of a kind of London-wide, London Social Centres network collective, which might be a good place to come if you are interested in setting up a social centre in your own area.
And that's on Rampart Street?
The meeting, no, it'll be in a new social centre, as yet to be disclosed. The meeting will be announced on Indie Media, and the location will eventually be announced on Indie Media. Or if you're a property owner with a large property empire of buildings just sitting there doing nothing, and you're feeling guilty about it and would like people to come and do something useful in your building, then let us know. I'm sure we can think of something to do with your buildings.
You can contact the Rampart by email, which is rampart@mutualaid.org, or check the website, which is www.rampart.co.nr.
I'm down in the basement of some dodgy building in East London with Fred Flintstone and
Miss Rampart.
One of the features of the new Indie Media Global Reports show is we were thinking how strange it is on the news, the radio news, how they have the FTSE report and they have sports results and various things that really, in the bigger scheme of things, are kind of irrelevant for a lot of us. Definitely not all of us. I know a lot of people love the sport and things and feel the need to make a lot of money. But meanwhile, there are some other figures out there that maybe should be getting just a little bit more attention. For example, the IraqBodyCount.org website has updated information on how many civilians have been killed in Iraq since the invasion. And that week it's standing at somewhere between 80,331 and 87,742. So that's civilians killed as a direct result of the invasion of Iraq by our government, using our money and our boys and girls. And another figure that maybe should be getting some attention is the number still held in Guantanamo Bay on Cuba, the US base, which is somehow outside international law. So that number is between 250 and 280. You'll have heard about some people being released lately, some British residents, but there are still 250 to 280 people held without trial in Guantanamo Bay. But in some senses, they're actually the lucky ones. At least they have some access to lawyers and the Red Cross, and some people know where they are. The number supposed to be detained elsewhere and disappeared has been authoritatively estimated as somewhere between 12 and 60,000 people. That is, people disappeared by the US, by that bastion of freedom and democracy, and that main ally of our government. So that's between 12 and 60,000 people who have been disappeared. So, anyway, back to Guantanamo. It seems like campaigns there have been having some impact. And the London Guantanamo Bay campaign will be having a day of action tomorrow, Friday the 11th, which is the 6th anniversary of the establishment of Guantanamo Bay. Now, the London Guantanamo campaign are organising this in collaboration with Cage Prisoners, and they will be meeting in East London at 9:30 outside Liverpool Street on the Bishopsgate side. And then they'll be going to the East London Mosque at 12 till 2, and also going for prayers, some of them. In West London, we'll be meeting at Paddington Station from 8 till 9, and then going to see the local MP, Karen Buck, from 10 till 12. There'll also be visits to the Pakistani Embassy, and from 4 till 6, the US Embassy. Finally, between 6 and 8 in the evening, that's tomorrow, Friday the 11th of January, there will be a rally outside the US Embassy with the lawyer Gareth Pierce, one of the people released from Guantanamo Bay, Moazzam Begg, and a variety of other people. So get down there, and let's not forget the figures that matter.
And that's all for tonight. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We hope you'll come and listen to our show on Monday between 11 and 12. And we wish you all an active Campaigning for Justice week from Indie Global Reports. Good night.